This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Joining us is Tom Woods Jr., a senior fellow of the Ludwig von Mises Institute and creator of Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And he holds a bachelor's degree in history from Harvard, and his master's is from Columbia University. He also appears on CNBC, MSNBC, Fox News, Fox Business, C-SPAN, and Bloomberg, among other outlets, and is a regular fill-in host on The Peter Schiff Show. He also is the author of 11 books, and I'm sure that number may have grown since the biography was written. You're a very prolific author, so we appreciate you taking the time to talk to We Are Libertarians today. And I'd like to ask first about Salon.com, which has figured out a traffic formula. It's great to get traffic hits when they troll libertarians. And they wrote a piece titled, "The Question No Libertarian Can Answer." And you wrote to answer the question, "If libertarianism is such a good idea, why has no country adopted it?" What was your answer to that question? What's your response?
That's a good question. It's been a while since I answered that. I'm lucky I can remember at this point. But I gave a twofold response. I mean, on the one hand, they said, look, we've had a free marketplace of ideas, and libertarianism lost. And my response is, what free marketplace of ideas could you possibly be thinking of? Are you talking about all those schools where kids get libertarianism presented to them fairly, where libertarianism gets a fair shake? If so, can you give me the address of some of these schools? I'd love to know where they are, because I've never encountered one. Well, I make one exception. My kid's school actually invited me to come give an uncensored presentation of libertarianism to the high school juniors, and we're doing it again this year. Well, I would tend to think you can count on one hand how many schools do that. So no, instead, the kids get, I mean, I love this idea that if you send your kids to the government schools, you're giving them exposure to all kinds of ideas, but if you homeschool them, you're just filling their heads with your propaganda. I would say it's exactly the opposite. I would say homeschool kids are far more acquainted with a much broader range of opinions than our kids in the government schools, who basically get the government line about, you know, where would you be without the government? And we all know that you poor kids would be working in a factory if it weren't for us, but thank goodness we rescued you from that, and here you are, you know, coloring a picture of Wonder Woman or something, thanks to us. Of course, that's what everybody gets. There is no free marketplace of ideas. But secondly, why has no country adopted it? Well, of course, there's an equivocation in the word country. What do they mean by country? Of course, they mean government. Why has no government adopted it? Well, you know, why does the mafia enjoy using violence and getting ill-gotten gains? Because that's what they do. Like, that's how they make their living. Why do parasites who make their livings at the expense of the working population not want to stop doing that? Well, I don't know. Maybe because it makes them better off. So I mean, the idea that the people, basically people who live, who are tax consumers, who live at the expense of the working population, would dispassionately consider libertarianism and say, well, you know, I think the merits on balance, this is not good for the country. It's great for the country. It's bad for you. No ruling class voluntarily gives up its power. That's really what the question is. Why has, if when you state it that way, you see the absurdity of it. Why has no ruling class in the world just voluntarily relinquished power? Well, I don't know. Why don't you ask the question and think about it?
Hey, Tom, a little bit more on politics. We recently interviewed Gary Johnson on the show, and he talked about Rand Paul and a potential presidential campaign in 2016, and he was kind of critical of people who took to Rand Paul and other Republicans in the so-called libertarian strain of the GOP as being libertarian voices on the grounds that Rand is more of a social conservative. Now, you supported Ron Paul's presidential efforts in 2012. Will you also extend that support to Rand, or are there enough differences between him and his father that the jury is still out?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't really know. I mean, I don't really know. And I think this has to be the earliest that we've basically seen more or less presidential campaigns get going. I mean, I know there's no official Rand Paul campaign. There's no official Chris Christie campaign. But you know what? There may as well be. I mean, Ted Cruz just traveled to Iowa and went hunting for pheasants, and now that's his avatar on Twitter. He's got a gun slung over his shoulder because that's his natural thing that he does, apparently, is he hunts for pheasants. And they just happened to catch a spontaneous photo of him doing that. So I feel like this is much too early to ask people this sort of thing. I mean, I obviously I'm more of a Ron Paul than a Rand Paul guy. But if I were going to not support Rand Paul, the reason wouldn't be social conservatism. Like, that wouldn't even that is so not even remotely the point of what the issue would be, which is that I fear that, I mean, it's one thing to say, look, most of the country is not libertarian, so I have to explain these ideas in ways they're going to understand. Nobody objects to that. I do that all the time. I go on neocon shows, and I try to say, all right, well, based on your premise, the neocon foreign policy has been a complete disaster, right? There has not one thing to recommend it. That's not the way I would explain it to a libertarian audience, but a libertarian audience already understands that point, so I can go on to the next thing. I have no problem with that. But my concern is that this is going beyond that. What I thought was refreshing about Ron Paul and that was so exciting was that he'd be on Meet the Press and they would say, all right, wait a minute, you actually think that Abraham Lincoln wasn't totally a saint, that maybe he did some bad things. Yeah, that's right. I think he did some bad things, and I think that the bad things he did have then been excuses for every other president who wants to spy on us or violate civil liberties or launch a war without consulting Congress. They all just say, well, Lincoln did it. Well, I don't think that's good. I think that's a bad press. I mean, that's incredible. Any other presidential candidate would have said, who told you that? Oh, I love Lincoln. In fact, here's my little pocket picture of Lincoln that I take with me, and I kiss and caress it and whatever. Whereas Rand immediately said, no, I think Lincoln was one of our greatest presidents. Now, of course, any political consultant will tell you nobody is voting for Lincoln in 2012 or 2016. You change the subject as fast as you possibly can. I understand why a political consultant would say that, but I personally don't care about political consultants. I'm not that interested in politics. What I like is somebody whose attitude is, I don't give a crap what the focus groups say or anything else. I'm just going to tell you the truth according to my understanding. That's what's exciting. Somebody who's going to measure his every word according to focus groups is not exciting to me. Like the Ron Paul campaign was utterly thrilling and exciting every minute of it, and I just don't feel like a Rand Paul campaign would be. I think Gary Johnson is a good man, and I respect him for a lot of things. But I think his obsession with stuff like gay marriage is totally misplaced. And just of all the things you could possibly focus on, when you look at the condition of the country and the NSA and the Fed and all these huge, huge institutions that are exploiting the hell out of everybody, and he wants to focus on that. I just don't, especially when it's basically a state issue anyway. Like, of all possible things to focus on, you're going to pick the one thing that's most going to alienate middle America and start with that. I just don't get that. That's not Rand Paul's problem. And also, the thing with the reason that I'm not saying, look, there ain't no way I would ever support Rand Paul is that most Ron Paul people, or at least a lot of them, when you ask them, well, is there anybody in the tradition of the Republican Party that you do respect, a lot of them will say Robert Taft from the 1940s and 50s. They say, we liked the Robert Taft wing. It was more skeptical of foreign intervention. It was more limited government. We liked the Robert Taft wing. But the fact is, Rand Paul, by any conceivable measure, has a far better voting record than Robert Taft did. Taft was terrible on a lot of. Taft voted for housing subsidies. He was not consistently a small government guy. He was not consistently an anti-interventionist guy. So by any conceivable measure, Rand Paul is vastly superior to Robert Taft, and yet there are a ton of libertarians who still say, I love Robert Taft, and I hate Rand Paul. Well, that just doesn't make sense to me. If you don't like Rand Paul, that's perfectly fine. I'm not going to bother you about that. But then you have to backtrack on Robert Taft, too. So then that makes me say, well, Rand Paul then has a better voting record than the best U.S. senator of the 20th century. Am I holding him to too high of a standard? So that's why I haven't totally made up my mind. I'm not deciding who's the best libertarian in 2016, but the same way Murray Rothbard always looked for who's closest to the Taft line. Not who's closest to Murray Rothbard. No one's going to be anywhere near Murray Rothbard. But who's closest to the Taft line, because he considered war and peace to be the most important issues of all. So, I mean, I can't rule out that I might say, well, you know, warts and all, Rand is the best representative we have of the Taft wing. So I might do that. I don't know.
Now, you touched there on Abraham Lincoln, and you recently did a podcast about Abraham Lincoln, and we all love the podcast, by the way. It's fantastic, and we're really excited to see a libertarian podcast doing really well on the iTunes ranking. So please, everybody, make sure you look up The Tom Woods Show on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. But you talked about Abraham Lincoln there briefly, and every other country in the 1800s ended slavery without a civil war. Why is it that America had a civil war? I mean, it's generally thought that the Civil War was about slavery. That's what we're taught in schools. But what are the other aspects that we don't really hear a lot about, and why is Lincoln a complicated figure for libertarians?
Well, okay, yeah, let's unpack all this, because I think there are two different issues here. What led to the secession of the southern states, and what led to the war? Now, the secession, I think there were southern states that seceded because of the slavery issue. And I think the reason I think that is that they came right out and said it. It's right there in the declaration that South Carolina issued in December 1860. I mean, they don't mince words, or they don't say we're seceding over the tariffs. And I've never argued that the war was over tariffs. I just don't think that's true. And I mean, that I'm sure that economic factors, as in any war, played a role. But anyway, so in other words, the war then was not fought, at least for the first 18 months, was not fought over slavery. I mean, Lincoln couldn't possibly have been any clearer about this. And any historian basically knows this. The general public doesn't, and so some people in the general public will get really annoyed with you when you try to make this claim. But there's no historian who hasn't read his first inaugural address, for heaven's sake, where he says in there that it's his understanding of the Constitution that the federal government has no authority to abolish slavery, and he says that I understand there's been a move to clarify this explicitly in the Constitution, to explicitly say the federal government can never abolish slavery, and I have no objection to that. So he had no objection to an amendment that would have made this clear. So therefore, everything that's done in the war for at least the first 18 months is entirely not defensible from a libertarian point of view. It has nothing whatsoever to do with slavery. Now, of course, the complication is slavery. And if there's anybody on earth who's consistently anti-slavery, it's libertarians. There's nobody who's more anti-slavery than libertarians. But what I did on my Tom Woods show that day was I just read a bunch of questions posed by my old friend Clyde Wilson, a retired professor of history. And he just went down the list, and he said, I have a presidential quiz for you guys. And he says, you ready? And so here's I'll give you a few questions, and you'll see the gist of it. He says, what president said he was indifferent to slavery but would use any force necessary to collect taxes? What president sent combat troops from the battlefield to bombard and occupy New York City? What president said that he had to violate the Constitution in order to save it? What president declared the elected legislatures of 13 states to be combinations of criminals that he had to suppress? What president raised a huge army at his own will without the approval of Congress? What American president launched a massive invasion of another country that posed no threat and without a declaration of war? What president sent the army to arrest in the middle of the night thousands of private citizens for expressing their opinions and held them incommunicado in military prisons with total denial of due process of law and had his soldiers destroy newspaper plants? What president was the first ruler in the civilized world to make medicine a contraband of war? And just goes on and on and on. Of course, the obvious answer is they're all Lincoln. So from a libertarian standpoint, it seems to me that secession has to be allowable, because secession, as Mises put it, is simply one part of a people saying it no longer wants to be joined to another part. Well, okay. I mean, the libertarian view, ultimately, is secession all the way down to the last individual. Now, as I say, obviously, slavery is not something that any libertarian can support. So I would stop short of saying I'm cheering on the Confederate government. I don't cheer on a government, which is why I'm not a neo-Confederate, as the Marxists like to say about me. I'm not cheering on the Confederate government because I don't cheer on governments. And I certainly don't cheer on a government that I do think was committed to slavery. But what I do cheer are individuals who are fighting against an invading army. And the way I put it is this. What was the average person living – the average person had no slaves living in the South supposed to do – because people say, oh, all the symbols of the South are terrible and should be burned and destroyed in Jacobin fashion. But what was the average person supposed to do when an invading army comes to burn down his town? Was the average person supposed to say, yes, Mr. Righteous Union Soldier, sir, you have every right to burn down my town because political leaders in my part of the country have made decisions that, of course, I have zero influence over, and these decisions have displeased you. So please burn down all our homes, burn down our hospitals, starve our children to death because we deserve this righteous judgment. Of course, nobody could be expected to do that. It's entirely honorable for somebody to take up arms, say, get the hell out of my town, and don't even think about killing the women and children and burning all the buildings down. I have no problem with somebody who wants to honor his ancestors for doing that.
So if we could jump back to some party politics real quick. There's a struggle within the Libertarian Party right now as far as debate access on the national level. We're also seeing it at the state level, especially in Virginia with the government race, or with the governor's race, and Sarvis being unable to debate. And the question that I have is, you know, will the Libertarian Party continue to do poorly on the national level without debate access? And if the answer is yes to that question, like I think it is, should the sole focus be on debate access, or is it time to admit that that's not going to happen and work within one of the mainstream parties to bring about some liberty-based policies at the national level?
Well, I think even from the beginning, Murray Rothbard was concerned that a libertarian party was simply premature. There just isn't the base of support for it. Then he softened on that a bit and thought that it could have an educational role, but he was also thinking that you need to be more discriminating in which races you choose to jump into. You don't have to have a libertarian candidate in every single race. But if there's a race where you happen to have an especially articulate candidate who happens to have built-in advantages, like he's the local physician, everybody knows him, things like that, local offices where almost nobody pays attention to them, very few people vote in them, nobody donates money to them, that's where your advantage lies. And then once you've built up enough party recognition in a local area where people say, oh yeah, our local such-and-such is a libertarian and the world has not come to an end, well, then people might be willing to think about a libertarian candidate seeking a higher office. So I would focus my energy. I wouldn't say there's no point in having a libertarian party, but I would just focus my energies more precisely. And then also bear in mind that I think the rising generation has less allegiance to the two major parties than we've ever seen since we had these two parties. And I spoke at the Illinois Libertarian Party convention this year, and I laid out what I think would be a very effective political ad for the libertarians. I would I would have it be an ad depicting life 40 years ago. I would say, you know, in the old days, you know, when your grandparents were kids, or like, we try to make it seem really old-fashioned. In the old days, you know, if you had to look something up, you rode your bike to the library and looked up a 50-year-old encyclopedia. We had three TV channels, and, you know, you can have them sitting there watching TV. Walter Cronkite told Americans what they were supposed to think. And we had two political parties. And then you have the sound of a record player needle, you know, being dragged across a record. And then, boom, then you go from, like, black and white to color, and it's vibrant and interesting. But today, we don't live that way. We have this, we have this, we have this. And we're not stuck with these two bozos. We've got the Libertarian Party. And then go from there. So you make it seem sort of cool to be a libertarian. And being a Democrat or Republican, that's what your grandparents used to do. Like, what are you going to go back to just watching CBS all day while you're at it? And looking up, if you have to look up a date, you're going to drive to the city library and go, I mean, like, you're going to give up Google while you're at it? So I would do that, make it seem kind of cool and kind of backward and stupid to belong to one of the other parties. Like, if you're going to fight as a libertarian, fight! You know, you have YouTube. You have a lot of people who would love to help out for free. Use it.
That's great. Hey, going back to the homeschool thing, you mentioned we were fortunate enough to have Ron Paul back on the program in August, and that was right before his School Revolution book came out. And we found out about that book sometime before its release because you made a Facebook post stating that you had either read an advanced copy of it or at least part of it, and you said, this is the book that starts the revolution. And since then, I understand that you've been working on an entire homeschool curriculum for Dr. Paul. Where can it be found? How did you get involved in that project?
Okay, you can find it at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And I got started in it because I was contacted, and the project was explained to me, and you know, Dr. Paul has wanted to do a homeschool project, a curriculum for K through 12, since around the time he started Campaign for Liberty. And I had raised the subject with him back then, and he was very excited about it. But we never had the personnel, and Campaign for Liberty never seemed all that interested in doing it, for whatever reason. Because, I mean, this is clearly, for the long term, what could be more important than this, right? I mean, just to make sure that all the ideas that people got excited about because of Paul don't just fizzle out. So yeah, I mean, basically almost all my time now is devoted to this. People say, how come you don't make more YouTubes or whatever? I just don't have the time. I'm spending an enormous amount of time every day. I mean, now I have my own show, TomWoodsRadio.com, and now I've got this, RonPaulHomeschool.com. Basically, I am doing 4 or 3.5 courses at least for this thing. Each course is 180 videos because it's 36 weeks, 5 videos a week. So I am recording a huge number of videos. So right now I'm doing Western Civ 1 from the ancient world up through 1492. Well, that's a huge amount of material to cover. And I'm covering it in ways that would be of interest to Ron Paul people. So, for example, I spend 3 talks on Aristotle, and I talk about Aristotle's politics. But in talking about that, I take about 15 minutes to point out, now, by the way, there's a libertarian interpretation of Aristotle's politics that's become current over the past 20 years. And here are the scholars who are doing it, and here's how they're arguing. And they're saying that it's true that Aristotle doesn't use the word rights. But just because somebody doesn't use a word doesn't mean they don't have the concept. And when you unpack Aristotle, he does actually, it turns out, have the concept. He just doesn't use the word. So I talk about this. Well, nobody's going to talk about that. You're not going to learn about that, what's called Aristotelian liberalism. No one's going to learn that. So that's the sort of thing I sprinkle into the Western Civ course. Then next year I'm doing Western Civ 2, so that brings everything up to the present. I'm doing constitutionalism, where I'm starting with all the colonial charters and the various colonial documents, analyzing all those, going up through the Articles of Confederation, the Constitution. Just everything you can imagine, war powers in the Constitution, money and the Constitution. What does the Constitution say about money? I go up through the debates over the Constitution, the early arguments between Jefferson and Hamilton, the most important Supreme Court decisions, just if you, 180 topics on the Constitution, including Lysander Spooner, who says the whole thing is doesn't make any difference because I never agreed to it. All that stuff is in there. There ain't no Constitution course like this. You take that course, you're going to be able to debate anybody in the world. And then finally, I'm doing a government course, which would be more like an anti-government course, because most government courses, if you take one, it consists of the professor outlining for you all the justifications of government. So don't tell me that that's a dispassionate overview, but what I'm doing is just giving one point of view. That's not a dispassionate overview. What I'm doing is then giving, so there's the government professor, here's why we need the government for this reason. But he doesn't give the other side of, well, wait a minute, couldn't we do this thing without government? So I'm basically, I am the equal time. That's the one thing, one good thing Rush Limbaugh said. People would say to him, Rush, don't you feel like you need to give equal time to the other side on your show? And he said, I am equal time. My show represents equal time. This curriculum is the equal time. So I am very, very excited about it. So we're rolling it out bit by bit. We've got some of the grades ready. We're still working on others. I'm going to be working on this all through 2014. And then what's left of me in 2015 may, if I still have enough energy to do it, do a course on all the wars, the major wars of U.S. history. How did we get into it? How did we pay for it? And what were the long-term consequences of the war internationally and at home? Now, that I'm not aware of any course like this, especially by a libertarian. And if I still have enough energy to do it, that's going to be an elective course for the seniors.
Speaking of civics, Thomas Jefferson is a very well-respected political philosopher in the Liberty Movement. But he was also a slave owner and made a massive land purchase without congressional approval. Is Thomas Jefferson a suitable role model for libertarians? Why or why not?
Now, the second thing you said, you broke up a little bit. He did what without congressional approval?
A massive land purchase.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, that was more a question of did he have the constitutional authorization to do it. And on that point, I know most people think that this was unconstitutional and that Jefferson then just sort of soothes his conscience by saying, well, if the people don't agree with me, they can vote me out, but I just want to grab it, Constitution or no. But actually, most of the Republicans were of the belief, Jefferson was very much an oddball on that. Most of them were of the belief, look, there are certain types of treaties, and there's like three or four, and this idea of purchasing territory falls under one of those headings. So therefore, it was assumed at the time of the Constitution to be legitimate as an exercise of the treaty power. So actually, Jefferson was an oddball among the Republicans. Most of them didn't think there was any constitutional problem with that at all. I mean, for a libertarian, though, it wouldn't really matter, is there a constitutional issue or not? The real issue would be, well, he bought the territory with tax money. Like, that would be much more relevant to libertarians. But that isn't so big a deal to me as the slavery thing. So yes, I mean, that is obviously a serious problem. But most people were pretty bad on slavery at that time. So we have to make sure we don't back ourselves into such a corner that we can't listen to anybody. I mean, even the Northerners, well, yeah, in principle, some of them might have been against slavery, but not if it means sending Negroes up north, which was basically the attitude. You know, I mean, there's a movie, I think it was Amistad, there's a movie where in the courtroom scene in Connecticut, there were some black men sitting there as spectators. They would never, never, never have allowed black men in a courtroom in Connecticut. You know, I love these holier-than-thou movies about how awesome the North was. I mean, really, most of the what were referred to in the census as free persons of color, who were people who had been former slaves or, you know, for one way or another were not part of the slave system, most of those lived in the South, actually. They didn't live in the North. So there's plenty of stuff to go around. Like, or for example, the Indian question. I mean, most people in the 19th century were terrible on the Indian question, too. So, I mean, unless we want to say everybody who ever lived sucked, and so we got to just start over from scratch, I mean, you know, there's consistency in that. But I would be more inclined to say, look, some people had real moral blindness, and I can't account for that myself. but at the same time, they had great moral insights. And so I'm going to take the insights, like Aristotle was not good on slavery, but basically everybody says that you'd be crazy not to want to learn from Aristotle because he did have very important insights. So I tend to be more the so-and-so was terrible on stuff, but also good on other things, so I'll take the good. But in terms of should he be like a big role model for libertarians, I just think there are so many better ones who were more consistent, more clearly libertarian. I mean, I like Lysander Spooner. I mean, like, everybody already knows Jefferson, right? So why don't we take our, you know, what clout we have and use it to publicize lesser-known figures? I like Spooner and people like that. I mean, even Martin Van Buren, who was the best, I think the best U.S. president, well, he nevertheless did oversee the Trail of Tears, which was the policy of his predecessor, and that's pretty horrifying. But then, as I said, we have to remember everybody was bad on the Indian question. Absolutely everybody. So for a libertarian, I mean, libertarians tend to have a very acute moral sense. And so, you know, I understand people's hesitation. I would never say to somebody, you have to honor this politician. That's not my way. But I just think if somebody has a great insight, then, you know, we ought to adopt it. And so half the time, we can use their own insights to condemn the other half of them.
So what do you think is the single biggest misconception that keeps the average American from making the leap from a more statist mindset to a liberty mindset, and how do we break it down?
Well, I think it's a big one, and this is the reason that I give so many speeches where I open them up in the same way, where I portray the situation as follows, that people believe that, and they don't articulate it this clearly, but in an inchoate sense, deep down, they believe that if it weren't for the government, well, you know, we wouldn't have any order in society. If it weren't for government, we'd have, you know, again, we'd have, everybody would be earning a dollar a day, and we'd be at each other's throats, and it would be chaos everywhere, and monopolies would run rampant, and there would be more economic instability. Like, they really think that government brings order, and government has really protected the people. That, yeah, you get an occasional corrupt guy in office, but for heaven's sake, we can't do without the thing as a whole, because it's yielded us, you know, better working conditions. It's given powers to labor unions. I mean, so it's just this general prejudice, and this is a prejudice that I think comes from, in part, the fact that people believe that the only way society can be organized is like the military. People, especially Americans, admire the military, because they say the military gets stuff done, because they're just tough. They just go in there, they destroy things, they're disciplined, somebody gives orders, everybody obeys, and look, they get things done. And so they think of social life, again, not consciously, but I think subconsciously, they think of social life as needing to proceed along the same ground, the same line. We need somebody barking out orders to everybody else who will then obey those orders. And, you know, what I try to do is give counterexamples to that. I was able to do this, by the way, most systematically in a speech I gave that I ended up calling the libertarian speech I would deliver to the whole country. And you can see that on YouTube. And I start off exactly like this, explaining the prejudice that people have in favor of military organization and orders being barked out, and if there isn't somebody barking out orders, nothing will get done and all will be chaos. And I give example after example of unbelievable aspects of cases of order where there is no person barking out commands, where it's just people cooperating with each other. And then I go on and enter and consider all these various ways in which people feel like government has contributed to the welfare of the public, and you know, for example, the labor unions or wages or whatever, standard of living, all these sorts of things that we think of because in seventh grade we read about the terrible Industrial Revolution and how bad it was, and now things are much better and we have more government now, so the government must have caused the better outcome. I go through all that, and I think by the end, you know, I think a person who is reasonably open-minded, who listened to that, may not be converted on the spot, but would say, well, you know what, I think this is more complicated than I thought. And that's all I'm looking to do in one speech.
What is the best way for people to follow you before we wrap up here?
Well, to visit me at tomwoods.com, I guess.
All right, great. Well, thank you for joining us here on the podcast, and we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure.